the most immutable database that humanity has yet built. And a killer app for a very immutable database is money. And there's, you know, the handful of other things as well. But on the Bitcoin time chain, which is geared towards simplicity, money is the best application for that database.
You're listening to CoinDesk's Money Reimagined with Michael Casey and Sheila Warren.
Hello, welcome to Money Reimagined. I'm Sheila Warren, and I'm here with my co-host, Michael Casey. Tune in every week to catch us on the CoinDesk Podcast Network or find our Money Reimagined feed on Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform. I'm so excited today to announce that Michael Casey's book that you've heard about on this show, the book he wrote with Frank McCourt, drops. It actually drops today, the day we're recording. By the time you hear this episode, it will be readily available at bookstores everywhere, including online. The book is titled Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age. And again, Frank McCourt and Michael Casey. We won't be chatting too much about this week. We did have an episode with Frank on a couple of episodes ago that you should definitely go check out for a summary of what you'll find in the book. Today, we're actually joined by Lynn Alden of Lynn Alden Investment Strategies, who has a book out as well called Broken Money. And we're going to be talking a lot about Bitcoin, its place in the geopolitical global economy, the underlying technology, and what unlocks, if any, remain to further adoption of Bitcoin and its broader acceptance. But first, Michael.
Well, thank you for doing my shill on my behalf, Sheila. Sheila the shill.
It's always
so awkward when the book comes out, how often you have to do it. And this is really not about me, but I'm excited just to say, yeah, it's so fun to realize we had a couple of moments down in South by Southwest, which, you know, had a decent crowd, but what was most important is the crowd was really engaged. We were so impressed with the questions and the sort of the interaction with it. I think people feel like we're talking about something that, you know, this is the moment. We've got to do something about this broken internet. But this isn't about that. This is about Lynn Alden, who is in her own right, absolutely brilliant, and her own book. I haven't read, but it just sounds fascinating and right up our alley. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. She has something of a cult following, of course, because she's really able to distill bigger sort of macro ideas into the framework of Bitcoin in ways that I think are just quite unique and very, very compelling. So really looking forward to talking to her.
Yeah. So Lynn, let's bring you in. And maybe we can start with just tell us how you describe Bitcoin to somebody who didn't really know what it was.
I mean, I describe Bitcoin probably one of two ways. One is what it does, which is basically globally portable savings and payments that are hard to censor, can be moved around easily, that can be self-custodied, basically digital gold, but also more than that. The more abstract way to describe it, I would say, is it's basically a decentralized ledger. And so most of the history of money and banking is basically about ledgers. And this is a global decentralized ledger. Kind of along those lines, a way to describe it is it's the most immutable database that humanity has yet built. And a killer app for a very immutable database is money. And there's, you know, the handful of other things as well, but on the Bitcoin time chain, which is geared towards simplicity, money is the best application for that database.
So I really appreciate that you broke that down into two different concepts, because most of our listeners are familiar. I think most people in the world, I would argue, are pretty familiar at this point with Bitcoin as, putting this very crudely, in my opinion, a substitute currency, an alternative currency. What they're not as familiar with is the underlying technology. And yes, they kind of get distributed ledger, it tracks things, it's immutable, like some of those things. Maybe they've delved into proof of work and why it's secure and all that kind of thing. But there's, of course, to your point, more that can be done with the Bitcoin blockchain than just the movement of money or value in that way from a place to a place. And so at some point in this episode, I'm hoping we can talk about ordinals, which Michael and I are both extremely excited about and have yet to have the conversation I know we're dying to have about that, to share that with our listeners. But let's start and go back to the beginning. So Bitcoin was designed to solve a particular problem, that of double spend. And maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about that problem, but also how that has evolved over time.
Right. So basically, when you're moving money around, you have to make sure that the same money is not sent to multiple locations, and then therefore someone gets shorted out, that they thought money had been sent to them, but then it doesn't reconcile on the kind of the final transaction. And that's the biggest challenge with decentralized ledgers, because if you have a centralized ledger, which most ledgers are, it basically comes down to the administrator, the authority of that ledger, to determine what is, you know, what payments are final, you know, canon, and which ones are, you know, not real, that are not part of that ledger. But when you're doing a decentralized one, there's no central authority that runs that. And so you need a way for all different copies of that ledger to reconcile. And research into this has gone back decades. So it goes back to like David Chaum, for example, of the early 1980s, and ever, you know, kind of multiple iterations since then, ways to make a decentralized ledger. And there's, you know, along the way, there were cryptographic improvements, there were conceptual improvements, and the person or a group that really kind of put that together in a workable way finally was Satoshi Nakamoto. Basically took a lot of those existing pieces and then added some of his own aspects to it, mainly the difficulty adjustment, which is basically a control loop to prevent, you know, kind of better processing power resulting in inflation of the coins, and kind of making so that the 20 million don't get all dumped right away from increasing processing power. So by adding all those pieces together, he made a way to have a ledger that can reconcile in a credible way. And so at the end of the day, Bitcoin is basically a spreadsheet that tens of thousands of nodes come to agreement on. You know, when we think of technologies, we often think of things changing very quickly, but protocols, so things like Ethernet, things like USB, things like Internet Protocol, that tend to be purposely simple, and therefore they stay around for a long time as a bedrock foundation for other more complex technologies that build on top of them. And they're generally upgradable gradually in a backward compatible way. So for example, Ethernet gets faster, USB gets faster, but generally you can still plug them into older versions of them and still be compatible. It's still the same underlying protocol. And Bitcoin is thus far, 15 years in, going a similar direction, that it's kind of hardening into this purposely simple, robust protocol that I think can last for a very long time, and is basically a protocol of value that is relevant as long as the internet exists, as long as we're as a species relatively connected together, and unless or until someone can find some other massive breakthrough that would supersede Bitcoin. But I think, as Adam Back pointed out, it's a very tight design space. Anything you can do to enhance Bitcoin, adding features, adding throughput, basically damages the either the decentralization of it, by making individual nodes hard to run, or it damages the security of it by introducing all these complex attack surfaces into it. And so because it exists in that pretty tight design space, I consider it like a protocol, much like those other ones that have lasted, in many cases, you know, 20, 30, 50 years and still going very strong.
And I think that's an important point to make, because sometimes people are like, oh, well, you know, when are you going to what's the next version of Bitcoin? And, you know, the points that you make about finality and security are really key ones. And thus far, for the tech to work the way it is intended to work and for it to provide the value it provides in the broader system, namely, to wit, the ability to secure and finalize a transaction, an exchange of value, without the need for an individual, a company, a centralized authority of some kind to come in and decree that is now final. For that to be done in a decentralized way, there really isn't a way to modify or adjust or change the underlying technology's operations unless you are compromising those two critical components of it, which the Bitcoin community, and I think at this point, the broad community understands, and I would say agrees, there is consensus around the fact that those two aspects are quite crucial.
I think I was really pleased that you sort of laid out the fact that essentially it's a ledger, and that ledgers are actually really, really important to finance. I wrote a book back in 2015, The Age of Cryptocurrency, just kind of really just pointing out this point, right? In fact, there's this idea, I think, that ledgers are, it was certainly double entry bookkeeping, the sort of like new advanced ledger key, was always all the way back to the Medici. Well, it precedes them, it's the Arabs, but the Medici who brought it into banking in the late 15th century just set the stage really for the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution, because it was a fundamentally new way to move money around and to build systems of trust and transfer. But of course, the Medici were the ledger keepers. That's the point. And then the bankers became that model. And that's the world we are still living in after all this time. So I think what's really important about your allusion to that is the thing that just baffles me about economists and these sort of like big financial thinkers who don't seem to realize just how much of a disruption the idea is that, you know, 500-year-old concept is now no longer in the hands of the Medici or the Jamie Dimons or whomever it is that's holding the control over the bank that's got the ledger. And so I suppose where I want to go with this, and what I'd like to sort of pursue this for a bit here, is, again, as I said at the beginning, you know, finally Bitcoin it's still not getting recognition. You know, you certainly don't see it as a mainstream topic among economists. But in terms of its value, obviously, all-time highs, you know, well above $1 trillion in market cap, it is a fundamentally important part of the global economy. And it is sending right now very strong signals about what people want in the world, what they trust, what they don't trust. When do you think mainstream economists are going to look at this and just say, wow, this is a change. This is something important, and we need to figure out how we coexist with it.
I think one of the factors there is how many times you see it not die, right? So anybody who looks at a logarithmic price chart has seen how many times it's not died, you know, higher highs and higher lows in every cycle. But most people haven't really looked at the logarithmic price chart of Bitcoin. That's kind of a niche thing in our industry. And people mostly just see the ones they remembered. So they might see the 2017 bull run and then the bear market after it, then the 2020 bull run and the bear market after it. Now they're seeing this like latest one. You know, when you see it not die about three times or more, it starts to get hard to ignore it. Another way of kind of looking at it is that, you know, at $1 trillion plus market cap, it's quite large now, but it's still smaller than some individual stocks. I mean, Apple has touched 3 trillion, Nvidia is 2 trillion. A handful of the other big tech stocks are, you know, $1 trillion plus, $2 trillion plus in some cases. And so I think when it, you know, gets larger to the point where it's multiple trillions and it's been through a number of cycles that people have seen, I think that's when it probably starts hitting critical mass of awareness. And I think some of it is also, you know, especially in academic circles, kind of the morbid way to describe it is that people don't really change, just new generations come in and other generations leave. And that's why new ideas take time to become mainstream. If you work in Wall Street, at least you have like a quantitative measuring board, right? So if you know a lot of people like say Larry Fink, for example, that were anti-Bitcoin, as soon as it kind of reaches a critical mass, and as soon as they are able to make fees on it, and as soon as it can affect portfolio returns, they're naturally going to pivot and not just be kind of off sides forever. They have that incentive to get back on sides. Whereas in academia, it takes longer. It basically takes that generational shift in many cases. And a way I would describe kind of the point you made about, you know, kind of the history of banking is that a lot of people don't really view banking as technology, but ultimately that's what it is. Mm. Kind of the path dependent of banking was basically people trying to figure out how to move gold and silver around more efficiently, basically to change legal ownership of it without changing the physical metal and verifying the physical metal every time. And so, you know, even things like, you know, the reason it kind of blossomed in the Middle East before it got to Europe was that's partially the direction of paper, right? So when you transitioned from parchment to paper, that was a technology that improved banking. And then even bookbinding, right? So they went from scrolls to bookbinding.
Ledgers could survive for a longer period of time and be trusted. They wouldn't be just, thrown away. Yeah,
exactly. And then things like analog encryption techniques, you know, if you're going to deposit gold, get a receipt for it, move the receipt, and then get gold from someone else in that network. Everybody involved in that transaction has to be able to make sure that that receipt is very hard to forge. And so you need, you know, encryption techniques against forging and copying. And then with the printing press, they could make more complex, you know, banknotes, things like that. So instead of all this stuff by hand, they can mass produce it. And so all those steps along the way were technologies that changed how we interface with money. And then the one thing I describe in the book and elsewhere is that the telegraph was a huge monetary technology. The ability to send information around the world near the speed of light, compared to previously, you had to physically go there with ships. Even the ledgers couldn't just move around the world at the speed of light. That also changed how we interact with money. But the key issue the whole time was that you always had to trust some centralized ledger. And even here in the 21st century, you know, basically, every country, there's multiple banks, they use a central bank as their ledger, you know, so we all have accounts at banks, we trust the bank to, you know, keep our ledger accurate. They, you know, they have their balances at the central bank, they trust the central bank to keep that ledger accurate. And then even central banks, when they need to hold reserves and do international transactions and contracts, they often rely on a bigger central bank, usually the US Federal Reserve, for example. So they're all tied into an even bigger ledger. And so it's ledgers built on ledgers built on ledgers, multiple layers of centralization. And Bitcoin is basically triple entry bookkeeping. It's basically saying, okay, here's a ledger, but instead of one central authority, and then we have kind of carbon copies of that central authority to try to, you know, at least reconcile should they have an issue, Instead, the actual ledger itself is just split up and reconciled across the world. And everybody has a copy of, not just a copy of the ledger, but actually has, you know, they're part of the core ledger system. And so it basically increases transparency and it kind of reintroduces scarcity to money, because when you control the ledger, you can then control the number of units and you have a lot of flexibility to do that. And that's why some people won't trust the ledger. But with this, you kind of have this concept of digital gold, which is that there's no unilateral force that can just come along and add units or subtract units or take away from this account or add to this other account. Instead, it's all rules-based and those rules are decentralized, which is a pretty novel and powerful thing. And I think it is somewhat surprising that more people have not recognized the power of that yet. But like I said, I think it takes time, it takes iteration, it takes size, and it takes just new people coming in and kind of seeing for what it is.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. I love myself some economic history and that sort of outside the box way of looking at technology. I love it, the idea that this is an ongoing iterative process of all these other technologies that we take for granted and how they're all feeding into this capacity for us to trust. And I think one of the things that's really important is the ability to abstract away with trust from whatever it is, the actual thing of value is, that then allows us to create these sort of complicated settlement mechanisms around that and know and trust that we are getting that real value moved or at least recognized and we're able to execute on that. So I think it's really important as a way to then, you know, again, step back a little bit away from Bitcoin as digital gold and just say, it's this settlement process, this unique innovation, the triple entry bookkeeping point, as you make, that really, really profoundly changed things. But I would say that I feel like, you know, most of the public conversation still tends to be around the asset itself, that it is it worth something? Is it valuable? And that we get stuck and caught in that back and forth. And I'm not even sure that in fact, that we've moved beyond that with this latest run. I feel as if, you know, BlackRock and co are probably just saying, I don't know why it's valuable, but a lot of people believe it is, and therefore we're going to provide services in it. But they're not yet at that point of thinking through this. So I'm wondering, like, what do you see in the world that is perhaps a catalyst to that more sophisticated take? And I'm wondering, for example, the idea that, you know, certain governments are now embracing Bitcoin as legal tender and sort of building systems based on it and so forth. Or is it other aspects of the way Bitcoin's being used? Where do you see this possibility that a more sophisticated global understanding of Bitcoin is starting to emerge?
I think some of it comes down to critical mass. So in any given institution, whether it's a government, whether it's a large investment bank, there are people in those organizations that have researched this quite heavily and get it, right? So, I mean, even just BlackRock, for example, there's executives at BlackRock that have read Broken Money, yep, for example, and read other literature in the field.
I wasn't trying to like paint them all with the same brush. There are definitely a lot of people on Wall Street who really
even
do
at the SEC, there are people who understand this and people who don't understand this, right? Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Carry on.
And so there are people in these organizations, and say back in 2017, they would have been fringe. They would have been, oh, that's the manager with the Bitcoin interest, and now that's cute, right? But then, you know, 2020 comes along, and it's okay. Their voices get a little bit more credible within, and there's more of them in any given organization, but they're still the minority. And then once you go through another cycle, it's basically some of them, they're hitting critical mass in some organizations, like, for example, Fidelity and BlackRock and these other ones, that they're more on board. That's now the kind of the dominant voice in those institutions, even though in some cases, some of these people have been there for quite a while. And so it's really kind of just going through cycle after cycle, having more people in institutions, and still, you know, instead of one out of nine people on an investment committee, it's five out of nine. And you kind of each iteration, each cycle, you add another kind of number or two to that group. And so part of it's that. I also think we're seeing kind of exhaustion of other alternatives, right? So, for example, we see, like I mentioned before, multiple countries are relying on the Federal Reserve as their ledger. We've seen, because of geopolitical conflicts, you know, people's access to the ledger can get frozen or blocked or confiscated. Whether it's a good reason or a bad reason, from their perspective, they don't want that to happen to them. And so people are kind of searching for other ledgers. And obviously, one of them is gold. There's been an uptick in sovereign gold buying. But gold is tricky because it's not a high velocity reserve asset. It's one of those things that you hope you don't transfer around too much. It's kind of like your longer term savings. And then so we see things like bilateral currency agreements. So, you know, India and Russia will agree to, you know, sell arms or commodities in rupees, for example, or Brazil will sell commodities to China in yuan. But a challenge with that is that all these different regions don't really have the depth of capital markets to facilitate that. It's hard. So the dollar has a very strong network effect. You know, all these different countries can use dollars, then they can take the dollars if they have a surplus and reinvest it into treasuries, S&P 500, private equity, real estate. Basically, it's basically a whole continent of investment opportunities under one shared rule of law legal system. Whereas if you are a country that's making bilateral trade agreements with multiple other countries, you have liquidity fracturing, right? So you can't just take your surpluses and necessarily invest them all into their capital markets. The capital markets might be less attractive, less liquid, less rule of law. Maybe, for example, fewer foreign entities want to own a overweight position in Chinese equities compared to U.S. equities. Or maybe if Russia runs a big surplus against India, there's only so many rupees that they want to reinvest into India. That's actually been a specific issue. And so they have these friction points that they're trying to overcome, but it's a piecemeal process. It's the challenge of competing with a very large network effect. And then you see things like, you know, central bank digital currencies working with the Bank for International Settlements, trying to figure out how to make these clearing mechanisms to right. kind of tie a bunch of these bilateral trade agreements together and have kind of BRICS agreements. But then it's like, well, what do you make that look like? Do you
right.
recreate
what's the denominator euro? Still? Right,
yeah, exactly. Well. What's the denominator? And do you recreate the euro, which is a monetary union without a fiscal union? They have their own challenges right. and they have their own lack of network effect, because even though the currency is unified, the capital markets are still separate. And so you have the same problem of liquidity compared to U.S. markets. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like the other alternatives are just all challenging. And Bitcoin has thus far not been big enough to really be a viable alternative. But especially for some of the smaller ones, you know, El Salvador, the Kingdom of Bhutan, the UAE, they start dabbling and getting interested, because if this thing should get, you know, five times bigger, or just in general, if the market cap, if the liquidity, is all notably higher than here, then that becomes a pretty serious alternative that it serves a similar purpose as gold, but then also can be sent around and verified very quickly. I mean, you know, famously when Germany repatriated some of their gold, the process took like 5 years. It's like, for billions of dollars worth of gold, you know, compared to you could do that in an hour with, you know, six confirmations on the Bitcoin blockchain. And so the logistics of moving around gold are just very challenging, the logistics of all these bilateral trade agreements. And so over time, the open source alternative, should it continue to gain higher highs, higher lows in terms of all the metrics that matter, they start taking notice.
I'm excited to share with you that our biggest fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age, a book I co-authored with Project Liberty founder Frank McCourt, will be released on March 12 and is now available for pre-order. Our biggest fight is a manifesto on the need to fix a severely broken internet with a set of workable solutions for all of us to follow. It's a hopeful book, exploring the big opportunities for innovation and prosperity that technology can bring if it's designed with humans in mind. But it's also an urgent call to action. We must get this right for society now, before it's too late. Find the link to the book in the show notes. Global crypto regulation, the disruptive power of AI, the rise of tokenization. Consensus is the one event where experts in digital assets, blockchain, and related topics convene to talk about the ideas shaping our digital future. Join developers, investors, founders, brands, policymakers, and plenty more in Austin, Texas from May 29 to 31. The 10th annual Consensus is curated by CoinDesk to feature the industry's most sought-after speakers, unparalleled networking opportunities, and unforgettable experiences. Take 15% off registration with the code MRP15. Register now at consensus.coindesk.com.
So, I used to talk a lot about normalization versus mainstreaming. And the idea that something can be an option, a legitimate option in an option space without necessarily being the most common, you know, option. And for me, when I look at the progression of Bitcoin in terms of its acceptance versus its adoption, different things, I think there was adoption, which had a curve different from sort of acceptance, right? And to me, like there are people, to your point about, you know, investment committees grow from one believer or whatever, a person understands this. I think a lot of people who are paying attention, who know the space, you know, as well as you do, as well as Liz has been following it for some time, understood the problem was trying to solve. We have to think about the history here. This is the wake of 2008, financial crisis, erosion of trust in these financial systems. People understood the problem. A lot of people did. They weren't necessarily convinced that Bitcoin was going to prove to be a viable option in the option space as opposed to a novelty. Fair enough, right? Over time, and so I observed this phenomenon. I talked about this back in 2015, this idea that we were going to see increased adoption and acceptance in countries like you describe, hyperinflationary, ones that had their issues, Russia, other kinds of places where there was an acute issue that this clearly solved is kind of a total no-brainer. As opposed to, okay, but is that specific thing really broken in my economy as I experience it, as is relevant to me? And over time, we've seen that, okay, there's more and more relevance of the tool, of the functions of the tool, of the specific design, the thin design you talk about, why that is relevant. But also the idea that the stickiness around the asset is consistent, right? It is sticky regardless of number go up, number go down. There is still a consistency to it that is impossible, I think, to, well, I think it's been impossible for a long time, but it's certainly, I would say, even less, it's even more challenging now to dismiss it. And so some people, you know, I talked about spot ETFs as a watershed moment for one component of this. When what I was referring to about that was not like the unlock of everything. It was kind of this idea that yet again, it's a step towards further more normalization, further acceptance, and maybe further adoption, which to me is a secondary question. So I'm curious from your perspective, do you see something else we need to unlock here in terms of understanding of this that would lead to more acceptance of Bitcoin and of the underlying technology?
So I think, you know, one of the primary characteristics of money historically, that, you know, for example, commodity money versus just commodities, is that people hold it despite not needing it for its end use. Or they hold it in surplus of what they need for its end use. An example of that is very few people hold excess oil, right? It's mainly hold in the quantities you expect to use it. Whereas a gold coin, you might never intend to melt that down and, you know, make ornamentation out of it. But you, the fact that you could, or the fact that you can sell it to someone else that could, is part of why it has value. So Bitcoin is thus far following a similar route, which is that there are some people that are using it directly for its purposes. International transfers or self-custodying money in jurisdictions where there's rampant inflation or bank freezes outside of the rule of law, things like that. There's other people in, especially the United States and Europe, that, you know, their payment systems work fine. They have all sorts of investment options that they can turn to. And so instead, they kind of hold Bitcoin just like any other investment. You know, they might view it as a tech investment. They might view it as a gold alternative. But either way, they're holding it basically not because they directly see why they need it to use it directly, but because they understand that other people around the world use it. Right now, maybe 100 million, and it could become billions, and therefore it should go up over time, and therefore they want to hold a piece of it, even though they're not sure that they're going to ever use it or use it in the foreseeable future. So I think as it stands now, that's sufficient. That's increasing monetization of the asset. When you go through another cycle, two more cycles, three more cycles, I think that that alone is very sufficient. And then we're seeing the build out of higher layers and things like that. So for people that want to move around more frequently, they run into fees and things like that, building layer twos, building side chains, building different sort of custodial environments that can all connect to each other, transfer money around easily. I think all that's important. We are seeing other attempts at application of the base ledger. So for example, it's long been known that you could use it potentially for security. You know, if you stamp something into the Bitcoin time chain, you're basically, you're not necessarily proving that what you stamped there is true, but you're proving that it's not been changed since you put it in there, right?
Like a notarizing function in a way.
Yeah, right? It's a notarizing function. And that could be, for example, showing proof of continuous identity. It could be showing that this document has not been changed. I think those are... They've still been relatively underexplored, but for example, in a world of AI becoming more and more ubiquitous and deepfakes everywhere, I think that's more of an interesting use case that's going to probably grow over time. And then, of course, anytime you have a utility use case, like, you know, proving the immutability of key documents, you have speculative use case built on top of that, which basically say, okay, I can put this picture into the time chain, and I, you know, it's going to be there forever, and therefore I can, you know, that's an interesting thing. I can pay to put some sort of arbitrary information into the time chain, and it's like a time capsule. And so that's another use case. And then with ordinals and stuff like that, or taproot assets, which is another way of doing it, you can, you know, kind of exchange ownership of pieces of information, or at least anyone who follows that specific protocol basically agrees that that represents ownership. So mm-hmm. for example, with ordinals, it's actually not, you know, that although the inscriptions themselves, the pictures or the assets like that are in the time chain, ordinals itself is just like a language built over Bitcoin. It's basically people agree to a certain language, a certain kind of ordering scheme for Bitcoins. And then as they send it around, they can say, okay, this represents this piece of information on the time chain. And, you know, right now, I think it's in its pretty speculative phase. I wouldn't necessarily people run out and buy JPEGs, but I think basically the underlying aspect of these different schemes that basically try to use the time chain for non-monetary purposes, I think that's a long-term minority use case of the blockchain.
Yeah, but I mean, a minority use case, but it might yet be proving a broader point that I think you're making, and that is because it is the one, right? It's the big one. It's the one that's been around now for 15 years. It's been proven. It truly is decentralized. It has this potential just to sit at the bottom of everything else and be that sort of arbiter of truth, that sort of base settlement layer. And I think that's what's really interesting here from a debate about, okay, what drives adoption and what drives value? Because I think, like, if we just looked at this purely from the digital gold perspective, a number of us, and I think you were, I don't know where you stood on this, but I was certainly reading a lot of really interesting stuff you were writing about the future of the dollar in the kind of COVID era. And this, you know, Ray Dalio and others looking at, okay, is the dollar going to survive this? And I was of the view that once the inflation outbreak happened, that this was going to be a major test for the central bank. I think it was a major, major test. I think the mainstream public, certainly mainstream economists, have come around and concluded the Fed's done a tremendous job, given the challenge they were up and where they've brought inflation back down to. I think the jury is still very much out. There is another shoe to drop. However, setting that aside, sitting around waiting for this moment in which the dollar is going to end its regime and therefore Bitcoin's value is going to be revealed for what it is something that's kind of just, you know, because you talk about network effect, you know, I think this battle over stable coins, you know, there's those in the United States who want a stable coin within the policy apparatus are doing so because they see it as a vehicle to actually sort of advance the hegemony of the dollar, to push dollars all over the world. So we may be talking, if that's what happens and that works, then that may be even longer into the future. It doesn't mean that the bet, if you're thinking about something that's going to last forever, isn't a good one to hold, that eventually the system falls apart and you need to have this protection against that. However, if in fact, even if that's one bet that you have, or it is a bet that you know, don't care so much about, this idea that this immutable settlement layer is what gives it its value, and then all these other things can be built on top of it, is a very powerful idea as well. How do you square that circle? I mean, do you see them as one and the same thing? Is there tension there, or should we just sort of like see it as all part of the same evolution to a system that is no longer going to be beholden on these centralized entities, be they government central banks or, you know, banks that run ledgers or any other, you know, Facebook or anybody else?
I think there's tension there, but I think it's natural for especially large structural network effect type of things to exist in parallel for long periods of time, because they don't just, you know, go away one night and reappear another day as something else. One has to kind of grow as another one fades away, or gets kind of, you know, basically the entropy of one improves. It gets more ordered, more proven, and another one gets increasingly disordered and increasingly in doubt around its structure. And so with the dollar, for example, we see the two main things that are causing some kind of top-down de-dollarization among countries. One, they see, you know, it's a freezable asset, right? It's entirely based on kind of the whims of Washington. And obviously there's a lot of entities that are concerned about that. And two, they see multi-trillion-dollar structural fiscal deficits as far as the eye can see, with no clear plan on how to structurally deal with that, especially in an age of polarized politics. And so, yeah, there's kind of two things that are, you know, they're not going to affect the dollar, you know, this year. But when you look out 5, 10, 15, 20 years, these are kind of structural issues. And then, you know, stablecoins, that you point out, are a bridging tool for a lot of people, because there's a lot of people in a lot of countries that want dollars. So there's top-down de-dollarization in some cases, but there's not really bottom-up de-dollarization. So if you go to, you know, street currency markets in Egypt or Argentina, or, you know, you name the country, it's generally for dollars. And that's a bottom-up grassroots thing. It's not imposed, right? So it's the fact that, you know, the most liquidity in Egyptian street market for currencies, most of it's dollars. And there's much tinier markets for euros or UAE currency or yuan, for example, virtually non-existent. That's a bottom-up thing. And stablecoins basically get around top-down de-dollarization by giving people dollar proxies, for example, just middle class in countries around the world. And so that partially can extend it. It's basically a way of giving them fungible T-bills that are usable like dollars. So I think that's a tool that, you know, from their perspective, it makes that sense for them to push. And it also makes sense for why people want them. But that's still part of a system that has just debasement built into it, freezability built into it. Whereas Bitcoin is more volatile because it's kind of going from zero to whatever its total addressable market is. Yeah. Whenever it starts to get too hot, people are going to build leverage on it. People are going to try things on it. Those things are going to break. The leverage is going to break. It's going to get washed out.
I always like to say, like, at the early, if we had a history record to study the volatility of gold as a mechanism for, you know, trading what were previously bartered goods or whatever, you know, we might have probably seen the same thing, right? Like we don't have the ability to look at how something evolved that way. Sorry, yeah. I always feel like there's this historical perspective that people don't get here.
Yeah, and it's compressed into a relatively short time frame in the digital age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when protocols are early, there's always a possibility that they get superseded. Like when the internet protocol came out, it wasn't the only competitor for that, right? And Ethernet was not the only networking protocol. Right. So in the early years, people are like, well, is this going to be the one? Is this thing breakable? Is this really the one? And so it's natural for people to either just dabble in it or ignore it for a period of time until it starts to kind of reach critical mass and network effects and solidify as kind of the one that has won the protocol wars. And so I think that, you know, 15 years in, Bitcoin's in that realm now. And it is more entities kind of realizing that. But it's still a process. And, you know, people they go through questions like, well, what if governments try to stop it? What if this problem happens? What if this problem happens? What if this other thing ends up being faster or better, right? So every year that goes by or every cycle that goes by, some of those questions get answered. And by the time that all those questions are answered, if they're all answered yes, basically they're all answered in Bitcoin's favor, then Bitcoin is, you know, whatever its end state is or nearly to it. It's a huge asset, bigger than any stock, you know, bigger than the monetary basis of individual countries. And it becomes this kind of gold size or bigger asset that's out there. I mean, at that point, it's, you know, it is the dominant protocol. And I would say we're somewhere between the first step and that last step, where we're kind of firmly in the Bitcoin winning territory, but it still has a number of challenges to go through and a number of people to kind of still realize how many challenges it's already won.
Here's what I find so interesting about this and have for some time is, there are some things that I think people still can credibly question about Bitcoin. And to your point, you know, we're not at like end game yet, but there are certain things that are clear wins. And one of those things that really doesn't get contested that often, at least not in the circles that I tend to be in, is this idea about finality and about security that we talked about kind of at the top of the episode, right? People pretty much accept that this is a trusted source of exchange, that when something is shown to have moved, you know, using the Bitcoin, like that is a thing you can trust. That is not really questioned anymore. Now, people question like, oh, you know, is the amount of energy used to do that worthwhile, moral judgment, all these kinds of questions that come in, they're going to come in, you know, to the end of time because people have their views on things and on prioritization. But the fundamentals about that are not really in question and have not been, I would argue, for about a decade. And so what that unlocks, I loved our side sort of discussion about time chains, and I wish we had more time to go even further down that, because to me, that sort of immutable characteristic of that the fidelity, the security, again, those things. And what you can do with that is, in my mind, the next big unlock. Because I think, what is that worth? What should it be worth? What should people be willing to pay for it? Those are all questions that, again, are kind of sticky and subjective. And you're going to have different views on that till the end of time. The same way you have different views on, is the dollar important? Is it viable? All those things. There are some facts there. There are always going to be opinions as well. And it's going to be hard to convince people away from their deeply felt opinions about things. However, this part of it, I just think, doesn't get enough airtime, doesn't get enough attention, because I think in the Bitcoin community, it's taken a bit for granted, even though to me, it is the most important thing about this entire space. And it is the differentiator from other kinds of things that do compromise on, you know, security or other kinds of issues that are really, really important, or even hackability. So I guess I'm curious to ask that question one more time and to say, you know, in the context of the global economy, in the context of things becoming increasingly digital, in the context of challenges at the nation state level around currency as a fundamental matter, which, again, political views aside, that is a fact that is happening. You gave some examples, you know, some would include the US, some would not, regardless. How do you see this kind of core aspect getting more awareness, like getting more awareness around that and kind of going back to fundamentals? Do you think that that's important, first of all, the way that I have just said that I do? And secondly, like, what do you think? Do you think it's going to be different kinds of products? Do you think it's going to be things like time chain related services that do that naturally? Or do you think that there is some sort of rhetoric that needs to happen around this that isn't necessarily happening to the public in general?
So I think part of it is just size and time. But there are, yeah, I think there are milestones that matter. I mean, one of the big debates for a number of years is, are transaction fees sufficient to keep the database immutable? One thing I find amusing is how quickly they can bounce back between transaction fees are too low to transaction fees are too high, right? So yeah, it's, regardless of what there's always a problem for some people, yeah. Sometimes the same people. But I do think that, you know, especially early on, it's a reasonable question. You know, as block subsidies go down, will transaction fees be sufficient? My view has always been yes, but we have to see. And it comes down largely to adoption. If Bitcoin was not heavily adopted, then in the long arc of time, it could become insecure in that way. But the thing I often point out is that right now, Bitcoin does something like 1% of gross volume of Fedwire, basically the biggest centralized ledger around, or at least in the Western world. And so in a world where Bitcoin is, you know, handling 10x the volumes that it is now, it's still at that point only 10% of Fedwire, what will transaction fees look like? And how much other layers, kind of like how Fedwire, you know, we don't use Fedwire directly, at least historically. You know, FedNow is kind of making that a little bit, you know, more compressed. But historically, you know, Fedwire is a settlement that exists underneath other layers. I think Bitcoin is developing a similar way. So as more people use it, as the base chain gross volumes go up, as more layers built to kind of condense transactions and put them into base layer transactions, I think that starts to answer that particular security question. There's also just the Lindy effect. How long has it gone without a major catastrophic hack? And one thing I point out is that there have been some kind of, you know, there was an inflation bug in Satoshi's time. There was an unintended chain split in 2013. There was an inflation bug in 2018 that was not exploited, that was fixed before people, kind of malicious actors, found it out. And one of the defenses against those issues is that in addition to being code, Bitcoin is a language now, right? Mm-hmm. So the 21 million hard cap, the number of new coins generated per block on the halving cycle, these things in some ways supersede the code. So should there be some sort of like bug or fork where one version starts violating the rules that are really known, like the actual, you know, there's code's complex, but the really core rules are not necessarily complex. And so, you know, there could be a test where something like that happens, and the language of the protocol ends up enforcing itself, that people know which one to pick because they know the meme of 20 million coins, this many coins per block, this halving cycle, and kind of go from there. And so I think that there might be still be tests to overall check its security. You know, maybe one day quantum computing is a test and it has to go through some sort of hard fork to become quantum hard, for example. There's encryption techniques that allow for that, but they take more block space. So there still could be technical challenges ahead that Bitcoin has to meet. And the more that it meets and the larger size it is as it meets them, I think it starts answering questions. And as far as the using Bitcoin as a truth layer, you know, there are, you know, Michael Saylor has talked about it, for example. I think he's bringing a large public voice to that. I referenced that in my book. There are small services that already use it for that purpose, for kind of, you know, contracts and things like that. So I think it's been around for a while, but, you know, as long as it's new technology, people aren't going to necessarily rely on it for that. But once it gets larger and bigger, and you know, perhaps you need a catalyst, perhaps, like, you know, being 10 times more prevalent and sophisticated than it is now is the catalyst that, you know, people start to wonder what is real. And it's like, well, we can trust proof of work. We can trust a decentralized proof of work time chain. And so, you know, there are catalysts, either one, the technology itself becoming solidified, or two, external things that reveal the need for that, which was not previously seen.
Ironically, yeah. I'm just going to cite, because I think this is hilarious in a way, the photoshopped royal family photo that is simultaneously making the rounds, right? It might even be something as silly as something like this, that people really start to question, what can I trust? How do I know? And maybe it's, to your point, Lynn, maybe it's that, maybe it's something catalytic that kind of, that makes that connection. You know, not that I'm saying that we should be, like, you know, like time stamping the royal family's photos or whatever, God forbid. But, you know, I mean, wait, why not? Whatever, but, like, not really my priority. But maybe it's something like that, and the identification of a solution that does involve these core attributes that might be the thing that kind of flips awareness about this opportunity.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap. I'm going to throw to you on that, Sheila, to do this formally. But I just wanted to just make one observation about this conversation, and that is that I think you're extremely generous. I also think truly academic, or at least scientific, in the way that you approach these things, and we're not like pointing fingers of blame. But I do think that one, you know, this whole conversation has been a little bit about what's going to make adoption. Where's adoption going to come from? Where's the resistance to that? And I think we have to acknowledge that there are, like, vested interests, right? And there's the obvious vested interests, which are, you know, just all the money that's rolled up, wrapped up in the legacy system. But there's also just the sort of the strictures of thinking that people have, that even if they can sometimes see that there's another way to think that way, it entails unwinding the entire paradigm in which they've been built. And I just remember, you know, I was going to raise this right at the beginning, because, you know, I was at MIT for a few years at the Digital Currency Initiative, and there are two types of economists at MIT. There are those that work at Sloan, like Simon Johnson, who was part of the Digital Currency Initiative and is really involved in innovation and the theories of innovation and where it moves to. And then there is the famous MIT economics faculty, from which, you know, countless different central bankers of the world, you know, have come through. And it really sort of established the framework around which so much thinking, into not just in terms of economics, monetary policy, but also just in terms of growth models and how you measure GDP, et cetera, et cetera. And so I remember sitting down with one of the economists there and just saying, you guys should look at Bitcoin. There's all this data, there's all these trends, it's a different way. And they just looked at us like we were crazy. Like, why on earth would we care about this thing? And I felt sorry for them. It's like, you're really missing a chance to build a fascinating new field of economics here. And it was extremely disappointing. And I just realized, no, it's just because I think it's those strictures, those constraints, and that's a different form of vested interests. So I don't know if you want to have a quick comment on that, because we do have to wrap, but I just thought, like, this is also part of the, you know, the hurdles that we need to get over.
Yeah, I think my wrapping comment would be that ever since the Telegraph, the power has really been in favor of the top-down ledger administrators, because when we had basically transactions at the speed of light, but no settlements at the speed of light, no way to final settle. So for 150 years, that gap, that arbitrage, had to be managed by central administrators of large ledgers built on even larger ledgers. So a lot of the existing establishment economic view kind of takes that for granted and says, okay, there's an issue of currency, there's a manager of the ledger, and it's top down. But the introduction of Bitcoin was basically the introduction of speed of light settlement, that bandwidth and encryption and overall kind of hardware and all the technologies have matured to the point where we cannot just do instant speed transactions, we can do nearly instant speed settlements. And that really closes the gap and reduces the need for those central administrators, at least at the core of the system. There's still use cases for banks, but maybe not central banks in the future, for example. Or just basically that even if there is, the top-down way is no longer the only way to do it. And so now there could be more grassroots, bottom-up, decentralized ledgers. And, you know, all the current literature, professions, and things like that are built on this 150-year-plus history of the top-down is the only way to do it. And that doesn't change easily. Like you said, there's vested interest either in terms of just their career prestige, their institutional power, either as Wall Street banks or as governments. It goes up the full stack. And I think that's a generational turning point rather than just like a, you know, it took a decade for smartphones to become niche to super popular. But this is more like the Industrial Revolution. This is more like a multi-decade thing rather than just one technology. It's like a set of technologies that upends an entire network. And that's a inherently just a slow, long process.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it doesn't happen fast, and it probably shouldn't happen fast. These are things that are pretty radical in terms of what the change is going to eventually look like. And I do think that we've seen, I think the points we raised in this conversation, evidence of very critical milestones along the way that continue. But I do think that, some people are frustrated by the pace, but I actually think the pace of dissolution and of evolution, this is kind of the pace. Like, this is actually moving very, very fast, all things considered. Because at the end of the day, we still aren't talking about even a full generation. I know we define generations differently now, but regardless, in the way we think historically about generations, we're not even through one yet in the life cycle of Bitcoin. So we have made tremendous progress, and that is continuing. Okay, well, we could go on for another hour, but thank you so much, Lynn Alden, for taking time with us today. Lynn Alden Investment Strategies, and don't forget to check out her new book, Broken Money, which is now available. And thank you, as always, to our listeners for listening to Money Reimagined. Don't forget to subscribe or leave us a review, and we will see you next week. Bye for now.